Hi, I'm Juliet from New York Times Games, and I'm here talking to fans about our games. You play New York Times Games?
Yes, every day.
There's this little tab down here called Friends, so you could add your friend.
That feels new to me.
It is.
It's nice to have the social aspect.
Oh my god, and you have all that times. That's crazy.
Right? You can look at Spelling Bee, Wordle, Connections.
Oh my god, amazing. Love that. I'll have to get the app.
New York Times Games subscribers can now add Friends in the Friends tab. Find out more at nytimes.com/games.
You're a star.
You're a star.
You are a star.
Oh my God. Everybody is a star.
It's our affirmation. It's our daily affirmation.
Yeah. We just like to let everybody know that we're happy that they're here.
I love that, man. This is a surprisingly very cozy interview situation. Yeah,
we're going to get way cozier.
I would say we're at like a 6 of cozy, but we're going to get to a 10.
Please get some of those, unhide fuzzy blankets.
You want us to go full call her daddy?
Yeah. No, like, but pajamas, that's kind of our goal. Like,
pajamas?
I wouldn't.
You wear pajamas?
I love a pajama suit, actually. I do back that.
You have that. Like,
oh, yeah,
you
yeah,
have
yeah.
like multiple sets.
Maybe not anymore, but I definitely do. I did. I had like 2 or 3 that went on tour with me everywhere.
What do you wear to sleep? I've never asked you. This is a very intimate question.
T-shirt and boxers.
Oh, same. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, t-shirt and boxers. Like, I used to, like, I remember when I was in my 20s thinking that it would be a mark of being an adult if I had pajama sets.
Oh, right.
So I just bought 2 or 3, right?
Yeah.
I was like, no, I'm grown.
Like, with buttons?
Yeah, with buttons, like a whole thing. There used to be a store next to Opening Ceremony called Sleepy Jones.
Oh, I know Sleepy Jones.
That's the one, right?
You had Sleepy Jones?
I did. I had Sleepy Jones. But every time I put it on, I'd be like, why am I wearing a suit to bed? At a certain point, no, they all went to Housing Works. Cheers.
Secondhand John Caramonica pajamas.
Wow. Rare.
Those are expensive. Those are fancy pajamas.
Well, now they belong to the world.
I love that.
That's the world's
That's
pajamas.
That's a beautiful, beautiful thing to share.
All right, shall we?
Yeah, let's work.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your crumbled down castle of music news and criticism. I'm John Caramonica, and I'm the critic.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, and I'm the reporter.
I'm Haley, and I think I'm the artist. I'm the singer.
You're whatever you want to be.
Who are you?
That's what we're trying to figure out today.
We got 90 minutes. We got 90 minutes. Paramore is the band that Haley has fronted for 2 decades alongside Zach Farrow and Taylor York with a revolving cast of other members.
Multi-platinum, Grammy-winning, humongous band. You guys started in a scene that was near and dear to my heart, the sort of mall punk Warped Tour set.
You see the long tail of Paramore not only in many generations of pop punk that followed, but you see it in the likes of Taylor Swift, Olivia Rodrigo, and plenty more young female singer-songwriters.
Across 6 albums, Paramore became known for peppy, high-energy hits like Ain't It Fun.
Ain't it fun?
Business. After long resisting the pull of a solo career, Haley began putting out albums under her own name in the year 2020. The third one of those, Ego Death at a Bachelorette Party, is out now. After 20 years with Atlantic Records, a deal that Haley signed when she was 15 years old, the band is now independent, and we're here in part to talk to Haley about what the future holds. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm very excited. I watch these, and I think I like this already.
I was wondering if you could start by just telling us a little bit about that moment in your life. You moved to Franklin, Tennessee. You meet these guys who end up being your friends and coworkers for the next 2 decades and more than that, of course.
It's such a wild thing to hear it phrased as.
It's true. We clocked in every day.
Yeah, but like these are your creative partners who you met at age 13, 14, 15. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that moment of discovery and sort of how it interplayed with interest from the broader music business. I assume that must have been pretty exciting for you guys as kids.
Well, yeah, I don't know that we fully grasped it. You know, I wanted to be I wanted to be in a band so bad from such a young age. I don't know what gave me the idea. I think I just had a deep, like, some sort of longing in me that was like, I got to find my people. And so when I met Zach at school, day one of this like little homeschool thing that we were doing, I didn't really cut it in public school. Once we moved from, my mom and I moved from Mississippi, my accent was so thick.
Can you do a little bit of your Mississippi accent?
Yeah. What I do know is that we moved like right before Christmas and my birthday that year. And I just remember realizing that when I said Santa Claus, that just wasn't really.
Wow. Even in Tennessee.
Yeah.
That wasn't going to fly.
People in Nashville don't have accents right to me at all.
Known fact.
And I remember practicing, like realizing, okay, none of the kids at school talk like me. And I'm trying to emulate the way that they're talking. And I met Zach the first day. I kind of just knew instantly, like, my people. It's because he really only talked to me through the language of, like, what bands do you like? What, you know, like, I want you to hear what me and my brother do. Like, we have a band. And so I was in heaven before I even joined the band. And I was the second singer of Paramore. I was not the first. They kicked out the first singer over Instant Messenger, AOL Instant Messenger.
Wow.
Tight.
That's how all breakups happened at the time.
Yeah.
That's true.
Artistic.
Legal.
Personal.
Yeah. Sociopolitical.
If you haven't dumped or been dumped via AIM, you're not my friend.
Yeah. You really haven't lived. But I just, as soon as I got to start playing with them, I felt like locked into my purpose in life. And again, I'm 13, 14 years old, but I kind of believe this is all hindsight. And I don't know how much of this is real or if it's that thing that you do that where you kind of you make up what makes sense in your sure adult brain. But I really believe we were so close to the Christian music industry. Like there were just industry people everywhere, every coffee shop where, you know, if my mom would drop me off to do school in the morning at just like at Starbucks while she went to public school to teach, we would be in downtown Franklin and like, you know, DC Talk, all these bands.
DC Talk,
like,
just hanging at the coffee shop?
Yeah.
DC Talk? Bunch of Belmont grads hanging out? Unbelievable.
I just feel like we were so close to that world that as soon as we started playing shows, when I say shows, I mean like we played at youth group, we played the school talent show, we might have played like a couple of little all ages things in town. And I feel like we got attention really quickly from people who had this sort of like whatever connection.
Yeah.
They had a system that they could put you in.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was happening in music at the time that you think they saw you in dialogue with? Was it like the Avril Lavigne of the world?
I think it was Avril Lavigne because, you know, the music that the guys and I loved was very much like, I mean, the people we looked up to played like 300, 400 cap rooms. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be Josh Scoggin from The Chariot. I didn't really care what was going on. I mean, I would watch MTV for fun, but it was a really big deal when like pop punk became the thing on TRL. You know, that sort of was the closest thing to the world that the guys and I were interested in. We were into heavier music and I don't know. I think, yeah, the Avril thing made people see dollar signs. And I also think that's why I was sort of plucked out of it. And I kept trying to be like, no. And I pulled the guys in with me. But that was such a confusing time because to be a kid who feels like, I mean, man, my mom and I really went through a lot in Mississippi. And my mom is such a survivor. We made it to Nashville. And then I met my friends. I felt like this is my purpose. And I thought we'll get signed to some cool little label that's like on the back of one of these CDs.
Yeah,
that,
right. You know, and they'll make pins for us.
Yeah.
And kids will put them on their backpack.
Mail order. We'll do send in money order and get two pieces of vinyl in the mail bag.
And that'll be it. My life.
We'll play little clubs like the bands that we love play. I mean, I had seen I think the biggest show I'd seen at the time was when I wanted to see Thursday and they were opening for AFI and mm-hmm. Coheed was on that tour. Yeah, that was
definitely saw that tour in Orlando, Florida, for sure.
Oh my God. I wonder where it was at.
House of Blues?
Yeah, House of Blues for sure. played the worst Paramore show of my life there.
I was probably there also.
Oh my God. We have so much to talk about with that. But I feel like it just happened so quick. It was like, found my people. We're writing songs that we love. We're doing these random shows. We're really too young to play shows. And then the next thing I know, I'm meeting L.A. Reid, Clive Davis, Jason Flom. I'm like, you know, that guy, Bob Lefsetz, is writing about me.
Wait, when was your first Lefsetz letter?
I feel like I was 15.
Come on.
We need to pull that out of the archives. And I'm just like, that's incredible.
I wish I had my other computer, which has all my old emails on it.
It was just a short 2 years of time, though, from getting there to like, oh my God, people want me to be a solo artist. I'm just now finding my space and my comfort playing this kind of music with my friends. And every meeting I would go into, I would just be like, you know, I mean, I already write songs with my friends. And they'd be like, oh, well,
that's nice.
Maybe you should go try and write with some other people too, just to like hone your skills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm 15. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. I met one of my favorite people in the world, though, doing that. And he actually ended up engineering Ego Death because I was like, you know, we never got to work together properly. And you've supported me so much. And Roger is his name. He saw me go through what happened with the label. And he saw them tell me with one face that like, oh yeah, you love Thursday. You love these bands. Like you guys can be like that. But then he would hear the meetings where they would say, you need to write pop songs with her. And I had a development deal with this guy that I guess is really famous for screwing bands over. And the reason that he caught my attention was that he said certain artist names that my 15-year-old brain was like, oh yeah, he's failure, self.
Wow.
You know, like artists that we were really into as kids. And then the next thing I know, Paramore songs are being shipped off to labels as Hayley Williams. And it was so devastating for me as a kid to feel like I was somehow betraying my friends. You know, it just, I think I'm still processing it. And it took getting off the label and being done with that time in my life to be able to have the hindsight and to be able to have grace for myself for not knowing. And also to realize, like, I was so young, but I fought like hell for my friends and we ultimately won.
You found a compromise.
Yeah, we did it.
How did you figure out how to
hold on to
have both? You found a way to please the powers that be and work with your friends.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it was ignorance because I don't think I ever could have realized what a system we were entering into. In the process of trying to figure out if there's going to be a label deal or not, our manager, Mark, kind of swooped in and really saved us. We of course, had no idea that that was the time frame when labels like Feel by Ramen were kind of being upstream to Atlantic.
The majors basically saw the boom in independent
labels. Third wave emo, whatever.
Which is exactly the same thing that had happened in rap a decade earlier, which is all the majors see the successes of the smaller regional labels, the cash monies of the world, and then sort of enter into partnerships with them. And then they're able to upstream the artists.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ones that they think have potential broad potential.
Mark was like, when he swooped in to help me and my family stop this development deal situation and this guy, I don't even want to give the name because it just, he doesn't deserve it. But he was like, well, you know, Atlantic's working with a label that works with bands that you guys actually listen to or like and kind of want to have more that type of career. So I met John Janik at a Cheesecake Factory somewhere in Florida.
It's incredible.
And like talked to him about the bands that we liked and the career that I thought I would be happy with and we would be happy with. And I was just like, we just want to get in a van. Like all of it ended up happening. But I really think it was a mix of pure ignorance and hard-headedness of being a teenager.
You know? In that first like wave, like once you're on the label and you're starting to put out music and you are in the van, I have a memory of seeing you guys play. Am I misremembering? Like, were you kind of in coordinated outfits potentially?
Probably, yeah.
Like, tell me a little bit about the first iteration of the presentation of the band.
Well, the first year, 2005, I was just wearing the guys' t-shirts. So, you know, we were all sharing laundry at this point. And so we were in the van. I didn't really I didn't pay attention to anything other than box dye for my hair. I just wanted to have red hair. And
and you have the hair.
Yeah.
It worked. The sort of visual hallmark of the band, if not the scene in general. Yeah. Between you and Pete Wentz, like, that's it.
And I would have never realized that in the moment, but it was just what I was into. And we just looked like so raggedy, but so cute on stage. Sure. We were kids. And then the next year, 2006, which ended up being the year we did our first headlining tour, which blew my mind. I told our whole team back then, I was like, yes, people seem excited about us, but this is a headlining tour seems really soon. And so we decided we're going to kind of dress. I think it was because we had done the video for the song Emergency and we kind of wanted to pull that in. Do you remember the 2004, 2005, there was this like Christian hardcore metalcore thing that was happening where like bands wore J. Crew and shit. Like
Bit preppy.
Me Without You dressed up, Norma Jean. They had a thing.
Some popped collars.
Collars. There was a thing. Yeah. There was a whole thing.
My high school is a quick Florida foray. My senior t-shirt is not a t-shirt. It's a polo. And if you pop the collar, it says like seniors class.
Are you serious?
Wow.
I can't believe that like Jonathan Anderson hasn't referenced that in the class.
Popped collars were.
I want to see that.
Spring, summer 27. I want to see that, Jonathan Anderson. I want to see that on the runway.
Like you mentioned AFI, like they're wearing crazy matching.
Also, am I right in saying the Hives?
Oh, the Hives were. When we played a festival with the Hives, it was such a big deal for them to walk through catering. You're just like, it's a spectacle.
I
do think we liked a little bit of that, but also, like, we'd get made fun of too on Warped Tour. You know, back then also you're on Warped Tour. Everyone is bragging about how long it's been since they've showered.
Yeah, right. You're just trying to go as long as possible until somebody passes out at your set.
Which happened all the time. I just like, man, what a different time. But the fashion, it's so interesting. During Riot is when I really started resenting it. And I kind of, I had the hair and then I had a little while, I would say through the first year of Brand New Eyes, where I was like, I am not dressing up. I don't want to be pigeonholed as this. But
it was your choice, like, to do that. That wasn't like the label, like the big bad label guy being like, you should wear suits.
You should look like the Hives.
We have our chief suit officers coming to the meeting.
I genuinely loved it. And I loved when I actually thought it was cool that the guys thought it was cool, you know, because I mean, as a young girl in the scene, you just get absolutely reamed for every choice that you make. I like definitely wouldn't touch makeup for the first year. I just didn't want to be called out for any differences.
Right. And of course, that's the way that boys at the time, like, they only know how to interact with you.
It's high school.
It's high school. Yeah. But
I'm sorry you guys didn't go to emotionally sophisticated high school like I did.
Well, Warped Tour, I don't think the most emotionally sophisticated of spaces. You were the only girl on those tours. Basically the only girl.
Yeah, there were a few. You can't know that you're swimming with sharks when you're in the middle of it. You have to just keep your head down. And like, yes, I would get comments. I mean, dude, the things that NoFX said about me from stage when I was underage and not.
Wow.
Like, you have to keep your head down. And I think I was also, like I was saying earlier, just young enough to sort of be, I was like bullish in the face of it. I was going to heckle back, but I was going to just keep moving and be not, I don't think I was ignorant to it. I just don't think I had the time.
Right.
I was sort of like proving myself.
Right. It's like, what would Kathleen Hanna do? But also, I'm a kid. Like, I can't, you know, am I going to punch a man in the mouth to preserve the sanctity of my personal space or whatever? Like, have you had the chance to sort of go back? You mentioned the guys in NoFX. Like, have they apologized to you? You know, have you said to them, hey, things really stuck with me and affected my life with anybody from that scene that you feel lasting scars from?
It's good for me to think about because no, but also yes. On Warped Tour, I remember saying something to Fat Mike after he made a comment about me and my mom while he was on stage in Nashville. It's embarrassing for sure, but I also was sheltered enough and I was like, young enough that I ended up seeing him in production and I like called him out for it. And he kind of didn't really have much to say. I don't know. It felt like he was trying to have that moment with me. We played a festival in Russia with them. It was the first time we'd seen them in probably 6 years. And I could just feel it. And I don't think I was really ready to allow it. Yep. I don't know how I would feel today about it. Cause I actually am, I'm not positive that, that it comes from a, that it would come from a like place of real understanding and empathy. I don't need the apology. I feel grown enough and like supported enough to be able to speak up for that part of myself.
What were your moments of awakening like along the way within that scene? Which, you know, I think looking back, a lot of people are like, not only are these lyrics, misogynist lyrics, yeah, but like these men were maybe behaving inappropriately,
yeah,
with fans and colleagues. And of course, this is not unique to the emo and pop punk scene, but this was a specific moment in time. And there were, I remember myself, you know, having grown up in and around it, when these questions started getting asked about, you know, what is the feminist read on this?
It was misery business for me.
It was.
Yeah, it was. Never change. Whore, you're nothing more. I'm sorry, that'll never change. And about forgiveness, we're both supposed to have exchange. Sorry, honey, but I passed it up. Especially then, I paid a lot of attention to what was happening on the internet because I was 18, 17, 18. And that was kind of where I lived, too. And I started to see some papers or maybe blog posts that were written by, I would assume they're like feminist groups that were maybe at like colleges and stuff. These were girls or people my age that were talking about just what it meant to be a young woman, not only in the scene, but just in the world at that time. This is like post Mean Girls, you know, like I do think there were more cultural conversations around like what we now call like a pick me and internalized misogyny. So I started really reflecting on that. And funny enough, it was at a time where I had sort of gotten into a relationship that was just so unhealthy. It was, I've always been really careful about how I talk about it because I grew up in that world. There's a lot of bullshit. There was a lot of definitely abuse and just people that shouldn't have got away with stuff. But I know what my experience was and I wasn't old enough to have it.
To be in that relationship.
To be in that relationship. I was not, I mean, my prefrontal cortex had another 7 years, 6 years, I don't know, to go. So I think that unknowingly I was learning from that. And at the same time, I was seeing this discourse online about me using the word whore in a song and me going after a girl that we went to middle or junior high with. You know, it was such a kind of like journal.
Yeah. And wait, it must have been intense because that's also your breakout single, right?
Yeah.
Like that's...
It's like why we're here, strangely.
And you've been on a crazy journey with that song
for
the decade plus since where, you know, at a certain moment you guys disowned it and said you would no longer play it anymore. Yeah. And then I think the last time I saw you, you spoke about bringing it back into the set list. Talk us through a little bit about that decision, both, you know, to distance yourself from it, but then to also embrace it. Because I think, you know, it reminds me of Taylor Swift and had the same experience with a song Better Than Revenge on Speak Now. And it was a conversation again when she re-recorded it. And, you know, this idea of do we claim things we wrote as teenagers that are important to our fans and our arc, you know? So I'm interested in where you stand on it now because it was such a fulcrum moment in your consciousness.
I mean, I was very embarrassed. That was my initial like eye-opening moment. The aha moment that I had with myself is like, oh my God, I have one girlfriend from school that I still talk to. I'm surrounded by guys all the time. I'm not seeing a clear picture most of the time. And now I'm seeing this discourse. I just felt embarrassment and I felt like I'm better. I know better than this now. And, I mean, it took us years before I knew how to really talk about it. We continued to play it. And then it was when Zach came back to the band. We were getting ready to do touring for After Laughter. And After Laughter, there was a growth spurt that happened personally, I think, for all of us as friends and as individuals, people. I was like, I can't sing this anymore. It feels so strange.
Tonight, we're playing this song for the last time for a very long time.
I don't want to be at a festival and have the footage that goes out from Bonnaroo be of this song. It's just not, it doesn't even really represent how we sound anymore. Like that we're three albums removed from it. And so I had a lot of frustration about the fact that we were expected to play it. And I knew that we would always be expected to play it. And we kind of like would do it on certain tours and we wouldn't do it
sometimes.
To almost like a soft, mm-hmm. whatever the opposite of a launch is,
right,
you know,
a soft cancellation.
Yeah. Yes, we were.
Soft
we
retreat.
Were, yeah.
But it was also 2017, right? So this dovetails with the Me Too moment.
Yes, yes.
When you were getting the initial pushback online, did you immediately understand that it was, in essence, correct? Were you sort of like, no, in my world, with my band and my scene, like, this is
like,
this
yeah,
is how
I don't
it's
hate women,
be.
I just hate this girl.
That's a different conversation inside of, I think we have that conversation in the context of feminism all the time, sure. because you can still not like people. Sure. You know, it doesn't really matter who they are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But
women can be assholes, too.
Women can be, we definitely can be. I think I knew immediately. I think I was convicted, and I felt the weight of that conviction and was like, yeah, I got a lot to learn.
You talk about After Laughter as this moment of freedom and growing up for you guys. It was the reunion of the band after a lot of lineup changes. And that's 2017. And then the next Paramore album, This Is Why, I think it's the first two Paramore albums to have the same lineup. Is that
what
correct?
What are we? What even is Paramore?
You know, like, it's a great question.
It's a theory.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Philosophy.
But I wonder those ups and downs, I assume for you, it was like an onslaught of gossip and rumor and innuendo. And especially if you were following stuff online, like, oh, the band is too much about Haley. I'm quitting. Oh, this person's suing. Obviously, as an adult, you know now, like, most people didn't know that was happening. Only people who really, only a slice of people. But I imagine that the turmoil that you were feeling from it was pretty intense, especially given the quote unquote original sin of Paramore, which is that you are the signed artist.
Wow. The original sin of Paramore is very nice. You are a writer.
That's, you know, that's why they pay us the big bucks. That was off the dome. I didn't write that down.
You get paid big bucks.
No, not yet.
What the hell?
This is how I find out.
I have to make some calls.
You know, I think back to that 2011 MTV like Damage Control.
Oh my God.
Did, which,
I was just talking about this.
Because it's just, I don't know. It's life.
Can you imagine us doing? Why?
It was like Oprah, you know, like when you go on Oprah and you're like, I'm so sorry, Oprah. Like, but it was MTV News.
I made a terrible mistake.
Wait, tell me. I don't know if I've ever actually seen this.
Go back and watch it.
It is like, pitiful.
It's so awkward.
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience of going through that, and did it ruin the band for you? Because I think that's what helps lead us to this solo moment.
Yeah.
Both the freedom that you eventually found in Paramore, but also just how rocky it was basically for those full 15, 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, not unlike the internalized misogyny conversation, I do think it has forced a lot of self-reflection that has been good for me. Like, it's good to get humbled by your own chaos at times. I think you got to look in the mirror about it. But the things that would become the story or the clickbait or what was so far from really how it felt to go through it with your childhood friends. That's just so delicate and such intimate relationships. Like, people still, like, I mean, even fans that have grown up with us the whole two decades, like, they just can't know. And I have to remember that. I have to remember that there's no possible way for me to explain it so that everyone gets it. But it was devastating to go through. It was just like, you know, I'm a child of divorce that's just never stopped going through a divorce. I've had literal divorces in my life, and then I've had all these friendship breakups, and I definitely felt like I was always the scapegoat or made out to be the villain. And I've had plenty of time to sort of like pout about that and shake my fist and sort of try to get my, find my center of balance again. And I think I can access anger about it. And I can also access another part of me now that's more grown up. That's like, who doesn't have these stories with their friends? Sure. Who even fucking,
especially when you're in business with your friends.
Yeah.
That's a way different.
It's just scenario. A family. It's a marriage. It's all the metaphors you hear bands talk about. And we've just not navigated it smoothly ever.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, Joe Manson's the original son of the band, you being the signed artist. Throughout those first 5 to 10 years, there must have been things that were presented to you. They're sort of like,
trying to like
you.
Pull me away.
It's
yeah.
just you.
The first time
those,
was...
they're nice.
Yeah, B.O.B. was the beneficiary.
Yes, that's right.
B.O.B. was the first one. Can we pretend that airplanes in the night sky like shooting stars? I could really use a wish right now, wish right now, wish right now. I was just talking about this the other day too, but like that was sold to me as a Lupe Fiasco song. I was a big fan. I was very excited.
Sure.
This is Airplanes.
Airplanes.
Yes, Airplanes.
Yeah.
And it was by Hayley Williams, Atlantic, not by Paramore.
Atlantic right. collab. Big thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Collab. It was like I got to know what it felt like to be the voice on a hip hop song. Yes. And it was Lupe Fiasco, mm-hmm. which was so cool.
Yeah.
Kick Bush.
And then, yeah, my favorite mm-hmm. one. But they switched it up. They were having, I guess, some success with Bob, and there was nothing I could do anyway. But at the end of the day, like it was fun, but it was like, we've never played that song live. Why would we? I don't really acknowledge it. Why should I?
It's a great hook.
It's a great hook. I didn't write it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think Skylar Grey wrote it. Mm-hmm. It was, like I said, like an experiment for me. And the guys were supportive of it. I mean, there were a lot of things that I even wanted to do that they weren't supportive of. And when I say they, I mostly mean Zach's brother, because okay. he was an ass. But
yeah.
But like,
who then left the band.
Yeah, yes. like, he then left. But like, I turned down the end credits of Jennifer's Body for him. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
no.
There's what? So much lore. There's so much that
what?
People don't
who
know.
Who doesn't want to? What's yeah, wrong with Jennifer's Body?
What's the downside?
Mean, I guess growing up fundamental Christian, you know, it like didn't agree.
Oh,
it
damn.
Didn't agree.
It's a demonic film.
It's the best kind.
Yeah,
I've heard.
Who's on the closing credits instead?
I think they went with Hole.
That's Jenny Body.
Yes, if you know, you know. Was the label at that point proactively like sensing that there was tension potentially between you and folks in the band, and sort of being like, maybe if we just offer her this,
yeah.
What if we just pull you in for a meeting? You know, like all the things that you would see in the film of the band, like the scene where you show up to the meeting and it's only you were invited, and then
they ambush me.
I mean, were there things, other opportunities besides the Jennifer's Body thing that you felt were an explicit attempt
to pull me away,
to draw and to literally drive such a wedge into the band that they could just have you all to themselves?
I think it was just built in at this point that I knew everyone wanted me away.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, because it's easier to put one person on the cover of a magazine because, you know, like they can sell a name easier than a band. And, you know, I assumed that in everything. And I didn't go to meetings by myself because of it. I didn't really do anything alone because of it. And I was very defensive in the way that a teenager can be defensive and sort of like, you're ruining my life about it. Until then I was like an adult. You know, and the good news for us is I always felt we were so supported by our immediate team. Like we've had the same manager our entire career, and we have new team members now that like have only made it stronger and better. But I feel like in a weird way, we kind of got a dad out of our relationship with our manager. And he was really protective of us, and not only of the band and how we wanted the band to come across, but he was protective of us as people.
And we talk about these exterior forces driving a wedge in the band. Mm. There's also these interior forces in the band seemingly driving a wedge between yourselves, your former bandmates. And was that resistance that you were talking about to going out on your own and being singled out? Like, is that why it took you so long to make a solo album? And what changed in 2019, 2020 that allowed you to make that leap and put out music under your own name?
I was a huge fan of what Zach was doing with his first solo project was called Half Noise. He had gone away for like 7 years from the band and really found himself. I believe he found himself in his 20s in a way that Taylor and I still haven't.
Because you didn't get off the ride.
Yeah, we didn't get off the ride. Arrested Development is a thing. Zach sort of like, he like fucked off to New Zealand, lived there for a while, made music. He kind of got to, he sort of started over. He did like a couple band tours and just made music like that he wanted to. And I, when he came back into the band, he had just made this record called Sudden Feeling. And I was such a fan of it. I was so excited that he was back in my life. But I was also just enamored by this new, I didn't know this side of him because he just really wasn't allowed, like.
There's no space for it.
He wasn't allowed to be a real part of the creative conversation. And that wasn't my doing. That was like bad family dynamics in the band. Like I think Zach, you know, like people don't know this, but when we were writing, Zach would sometimes come in the room with me while I would just be like working away, trying to figure out my parts, and he would suggest stuff. So like the woes and That's What You Get are him. Wow. There's background parts on our, right? Yeah. Yeah. Damn. There's like background parts on some of our first demos that are him telling me what to do. Like he's
sneaking contributions to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm really proud of him because he's come out from under the thumb of, I think, family dynamics that were unhealthy for him. And I was so inspired by that courage and obviously the sound as well. And I just, I don't know, we knew we were going to take a break from the band. And I just thought, he's doing it and it's not a big deal. It's actually not, it's feeding the band, if anything else. And I'm also a fan of bands like the Talking Heads or Radiohead. All these members have their own projects, you know, and I think I was just interested in that life because I still don't really know how this all shakes out. Like, we're just going to keep getting older and I want to be an artist, you know, until I die. And I think that's going to look a thousand ways. So this was my first kind of the first way that I got to try it out. And those first two, now when I look back at it, I'm like, man, I still was so, it was just the trepidation. Like, I just felt so cautious. I didn't realize how cautious I was still being, but scary. I knew people would single me out and it would be rightly so this time. So,
you were also going through a divorce.
Went through a divorce.
Did that
during
seem like
laughter.
Something you could only channel into solo music and not Paramore music?
Well, when we were writing After Laughter, it was more, it kind of manifested as writing about my own mental health in a way that I hadn't really been able to access before. So yeah, then when Petals happened, my divorce had been finalized and I really got to process it. And a lot of that stuff needed to come out. I needed to say so much of that for me. And that's also how I treat writing. So every project has been like, I gotta get this out of my body. And yeah, I mean, I think the band has, we've always taken these giant breaks ever since the 2011, like the real drama of Zach and his brother leaving. We've just taken these giant breaks between album cycles. And
you needed to fill the space somehow with music.
Yeah, I was processing too quick to wait another 4 or 5 years to like see how, where it goes, you know?
Hi, this is Ashley. I live in San Francisco with my boyfriend. We would love to officially share my New York Times subscription with separate logins. We both love cooking, love being in the kitchen, but I'm a 30-minute and under efficient dinner girly. I want a sheet pan meal. He is very elaborate. He wants to get into the storytelling. I want to be able to save my easy meals and check off the ones that I've completed. And I think him having his own profile would be great.
Ashley, we heard you. Introducing the New York Times Family Subscription. You get your own login, and Mr. Elaborate gets his. Plus, room for two others. Find out more at nytimes.com/family.
Paramore is an extremely beloved band. This is something that comes up from, you know, younger artists, people in a variety of traditions. A lot of people talk about your vocals specifically, like an awareness of the interest and anticipation of you as an individual. I wonder what that felt like, especially after being so firmly insistent in the earliest years that they're like, it's not me. It's us. It's not me. But then what happens is with the success of the band and the success of those, especially the early albums, everybody's like, maybe it is, you know, yeah. right? Which is an inevitability. Yeah. But I wonder how much of that anticipation and an open reception, I'm sure people were saying, hey, I would love to have you sing on this. If you ever want to come out to a concert and sing us, like, tell me about the leap into the unknown, except you know that on some level people want that, whether it's other musicians or fans.
I don't typically like to do the thing that people expect or want me to do. I mean, I think that's probably not always a great thing about me. So I did feel a bit defeatist about it, about finally giving into this thing that
I've been resisting.
I had been resisting it like my whole life. It felt like now I'm giving into it. I'm going to let the water take me and see how it goes. It was really scary. I think the one thing that sort of got me through that was the fact that we had been around for so long. I had to remember that there was some level of understanding of the context of where I come from.
Right.
You know?
You're not just it's not the random thing where you show up on the B.O.B. record. It's that there are people who maybe are inspired or influenced by your work who now have an opportunity for you and say, I have a stage. Yeah. I have an album.
Yes.
So that must have felt welcome. Like, yeah. That probably helped erase the hesitation.
It totally did. And I'll say now, like, I mean, it's really weird that I have three of these albums with my name on them. I didn't see that coming in a zillion years. But I would say this time around, I feel the most, I've had the most moments where, like, I read something that someone's written about it, about the project, and I'll find myself like a little teary, because it's such a strange thing to grow up in this world. You're already, like, I was a teenager, you're already like feeling misunderstood all the time. And I do think that a part of me got stuck there, got really trapped there. And this project and the way that people are talking to me about it, I get to feel like a whole person. I don't have to, you know, have this caveat of like, but I'm in this band. Like, I trust that people know that. And if they don't and they like what I'm doing anyway, well, sick. I mean, I do feel a bit more understood, which is not a guarantee in this life that you're going to ever feel that way. So I'm having like a lot more full circle, like hugging my inner child moments.
The signal to me that you were comfortable with it finally was the t-shirt, Hayley Williams is my favorite band, which basically encapsulates the whole, you know, previous 45 minutes of conversation that we've had. You know, it's like, have you ever sat down with Gwen Stefani?
Oh, well, we opened for No Doubt in 2009.
But have you had this conversation?
No. I think back then I thought I was having that conversation with her anytime we talked, because I was just listening. I was listening between the words. I was trying to pay attention to her body language and like how it seemed that they had grown up together. Obviously, there's been a lot of shit and their bands. Yeah,
they were the blueprint for the Paramore drama.
Unfortunately,
in terms of band members coming and going, relationships, the pull of the solo career. But then what happened is you didn't do the Gwen Stefani. When Gwen Stefani went solo, she made Pharrell Records.
Yeah,
when
you went like solo,
you went insular. You went deeper in. I think that's a good moment to talk about Ego Death and the way that you rolled it out, which was a bit chaotic, I will say.
Yeah,
but maybe by design, you first put out 17 singles randomly on a website, then on streaming, not aggregated. And it's since become an album, which will eventually be physically released. Why?
I really needed to write about a lot of things. The end of the contract happened and I could see it coming. We were finishing This Is Why, and it was like the light at the end of the tunnel. But strangely, as I got closer, it felt more daunting. And I think it's because there was so much I hadn't really ever processed about everything that we've just talked about, and more. So it all really felt like it was going to come out whether or not I put it anywhere. It just was like I was going to puke everywhere. And putting it out the way that we did was basically just trying to share that experience. But it was also the real crux of it for me is I really only care about the people that in terms of who's going to take this in and listen to it and get something out of it. That's all I care about. I don't need to make more fans. I've had such a cool career.
It's an anti-commercial move to release it this way.
Thank you. What a great compliment. Cause I just feel that subculture right now, it's always been important, but I think we really need to dive into community and what we're the most passionate about, because that's sustainable stuff. When I think about the issues that I care about politically, socially, I gotta have energy around them. So who am I connecting with? Who am I speaking to? I kind of feel like putting out the music this way allowed me to sort of speak in code to the people who actually give a shit about Paramore, and confuse the writers and the people that, you know, love to just put a Paramore think piece out every few,
looking for an easy sort of the quickest, most simplistic summation of a thing.
And all they're going to do is just write facts in it. They're not going to dig into what the songs are about or what production is, what choices were being made and why. Like, I kind of just wanted to be like, you know, that's going to happen anyway, but I want to just go straight to the source and to like tap into the people that are there. They're already there. And we've been having a conversation for 20 years. I needed to feel like I also got to be the kind of artist that I wanted to be before a major label found me.
There is a stretch in the middle of the record. And when you say the artist that you want to be, I'm guessing is one that can reference the Bloodhound Gang. And then two songs later have a song about racial tensions in the South and how the South will never kind of elevate if it doesn't directly confront its terrible history. That's the artist that you want to be. Can you tell me about, frankly, both of those decisions, sure, both of those songs, mm-hmm, and how you see them in concert with each other?
You and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals, so let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel.
Wow. I mean, I like so many kinds of music, as does the band. I can never plan, I want to make this kind of record. I could even say I want to make this kind of record and it might inform some part of it, but like there was so much like grief happening in my body while writing. It just felt like every day was an exercise of seeing how much of it I could get out in one go so that I can be clean from it and just like keep moving. I so desperately want to divorce the part of myself that had to just, you know, I really had to grin and bear a lot of shit in our career. And that's not to say we haven't enjoyed so 99% of it. We've been so lucky. Yeah. We have such a cool thing going with Paramore still, which is, that's another part of it. Like, how are we still here? But yeah, I just, one day it was about, I don't know, like the band and grieving what I thought Paramore was. I really, this is a whole other conversation, but I really have decided that while I was deconstructing my faith and my religious upbringing from around age 19 to forever, I really didn't realize how much of Paramore for me was a religious experience, a God pillar in my life.
Instead of the organized religion you grew up with. Instead of
God, it was like Paramore is the backdrop to every conversation.
It's the organizing principle.
Yeah. So songs like Discovery Channel are really me kind of like roaming the halls of those, of whatever that structure is and just trying to take it apart more. True Believer is like, I mean, I'm never not ready to scream at the top of my lungs about racial issues. Thing that gets me the most angry. I think because it's so intersectional that it overlaps with everything from climate change to like LGBTQIA plus issues. But Nashville, the reason I was writing about Nashville a lot is that we came home from tour and I thought, well, I'm going to go to LA. This will be my third move to LA, but this one's going to stick.
Get me out of here.
It's like Trump just got elected again and I don't want to be in a red state.
Mm-hmm. And Nashville is a capital of this culture, this whatever the new American culture is, the mainstream culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of it is based, if not in Austin, in Nashville. And I'm sure you were feeling that. Mm-hmm. There's a line on the title track, Ego Death, where you say something like, I'm the most famous girl in this racist country singer's bar.
I'll be the biggest star at this racist country singer's bar.
Could be a couple different.
It could be a couple, but I'm always talking about Morgan Wallen. I don't give a shit. Find me at Whole Foods, bitch. I don't care.
Oh, man.
Look, and I think it's important for you to be able to speak that truth, but I also think it relates directly to Paramore and your fan base. John and I have spoken a lot over the years. There's been a lot written over the years about the diversity of your fan base, about Paramore's black fans in particular.
A recurrent TikTok theme. I feel like once every month or once every 2 months, there will be a TikTok explosion where a black fan is just going absolutely crazy. And then I've seen ones where you and maybe other folks in the band respond to it.
And I've seen great explanations for it. You know, people love your sort of gospel influence, which I think comes from growing up in the South,
and of course
in churches, and there's a lot of that in your vocals. You have a lot of soul.
Thank you
for a white girl. I think like we all know that. I'm not the first or the best person to tell you that, but I think you know it's well established. Like you know the little Uzi Vert eating gummies, dancing to Paramore, one of my favorite internet clips of all time.
Yeah.
But why do you think that is? Because it's also like, maybe I thought it was an internet meme for a couple of years. And then the last time I saw you guys at Radio City, I was like, oh no, this is the most diverse crowd I've probably ever seen at a rock concert.
That's so cool.
At least in recent history.
I feel that too now more than I did growing up. It definitely shifted around the self-titled record. We started saying yes to a lot more. I was just talking to Leah, she's one of my managers now. And we were talking about how she wasn't around for the period of time where we just said yes to everything. We were like playing The Voice and we were like playing, you know, we were just saying yes to, I think a lot more people got introduced to our band during that time. People that maybe weren't welcome in the scene that we grew up in. So I do think that having like songs like Ain't It Fun come out, which were like, when Taylor and I were writing that, I was like, playing these synth parts and going like, oh, it's like Stevie Wonder, you know, like we were referencing black artists only when we were trying to put that particular song together. But I do think that the amount of space we decided we were okay taking up and the places we were okay showing up in just let different people that hadn't really been privy to what we were doing or what we were about feel maybe a little bit more welcome to come into the show. And then I'll never forget watching Stop Making Sense during while we were recording After Laughter and watching the camera pan across the crowd, seeing how diverse it was. And I just got really teary. And obviously there's like some of the best black musicians like on stage with them, and they're on stage. They're all working together as if they are all the talking heads. There was no separation. It just felt like this celebration of like humanity. And I was like, that's what I want it to feel like. And I don't know if that was manifestation or if it was just all completely out of our control. We couldn't have done anything for or against it. But I had this moment towards the end of After Laughter. We're playing a show and I kind of looked across the crowd and I just was like, we're doing it. We're here with all these people that the music gives them a space. It makes them feel a part of something. And that's the only feeling that I've ever wanted since I was a kid in Mississippi. I just wanted to feel a part of something and I wanted to feel safe in it. And yeah, I mean, now it's like you said, the TikToks and it is memeable at this point. It's not really, sometimes I think it gets like, how like blown out of proportion is it really? But to your point, then I'll go to a play, we'll play a show and I'll
see the proof.
Yeah. It's just, I'm so proud of that because I'm very passionate that we have a long way to go in making, and, you know, to make people feel that they belong in the world. And the repercussions of people not feeling like they're a part or they belong, we see it all the time in the news. And I just, I don't know. I think music is the kind of the, not only the easiest, but the most beautiful way to tap into people's hearts and their subconscious and change their minds and have people show up to a show and stand next to someone that they may never see again, but they're going to share this really wholesome, cathartic moment. You know, that's like, that's the kind of shows I want to be at. And it's not really the kind of shows I grew up going to. I just went to my first Newport Folk Festival this year, and I thought this is the punkest festival I've ever been at. And I grew up at punk festivals, apparently. So I think that sometimes it's a costume, and sometimes it's a heart matter. And the thing that I'm really thankful for is I grew up going to like some hardcore shows and shows where I do feel like there was a sense of unity and there was like,
there's community, even if it's a specific community. Yeah.
Yeah. And people are learning how to work together to create something. And, you know, like you got like 15-year-old kids promoting shows. Those shows were really cathartic. But now when I think about what I really need in terms of like the world I really choose to see or to want to see, it's not those rooms. I want to be in those rooms, but I really want the contents of the rooms to change. When someone tells me that I'm a part of helping that change happen, that's when I'm like, well, that's the job. That's the work.
Including speaking about political and social issues?
For me, yes. And I still think you got to be smart and know when is the moment or when it's just going to, it's like out of your hands anyways. But I think, yes, I think it's, why not? You know, and the other half to that is just, You can't be educated about everything all the time to the extent that I think you should be to speak on something. But when you're passionate about something and you really believe in something and you have the will to spread that, I think, yeah, talk about it. Talk about it from stage. Or if that's not comfortable or doesn't feel safe, like there's still plenty of opportunities to have those conversations, you know? I'm still figuring that out now.
Just even hearing you say that, I'm thinking back to what you said 45 minutes ago about the Warped Tour and Fat Mike and the types of things that were being said on that stage.
Yeah.
And the fact that now the full circle moment is having the opportunity to say a whole different set of things on stage. Yeah.
Growing up on the Warped Tour, I mean, I really, it's very disillusioning, like to come out of it and realize like, nobody was talking politics on those stages. Not really.
Maybe a little bit of voter registration, 2003, 2004, but not.
We weren't even on the Warped Tour on those years. Like, that was right before us.
That moment in quote unquote punk music was not about politics necessarily. It was more about style.
It was more about style and maybe some social stuff,
sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I think like, I had to learn. I felt like I had to learn on my own how to do it, how to talk about that stuff. Cause I wasn't looking around me and seeing other people do it in a way that felt well at all. This year I met Kathleen Hanna. We did this thing at the Rock Hall together. First time ever meeting her. I walked into the exhibit. It was like the women in rock. And it's so many, I mean, I walked in and just immediately started crying. Cause I got to sort of hug this younger version of myself that I think really felt alone and probably scared a lot of the time and be like, you were always a part of that. And I got to talk to her about that. And I got to talk about how you're kind of unlikable when you talk about the same issue over and over again with passion. Like it's not, you know, it's not the, people resent it. And I don't know why. It could be a million reasons. They could agree with you and still be annoyed. But, I just didn't have a lot of like, I didn't have a lot of mentors really, other than our manager. And I like, he did a great job in my opinion, but
he raised you well.
He raised us.
But no women in the band.
Mentors, not really. Like maybe some of the women in production at Warped Tour were really sweet to me and really kind, but like, I think it would have been so cool to have met, you know, to have met Kathleen back then, or to shit, like literally name a woman in a punk band that like that came before us. I think it just would have been nice.
But you're isolated from them.
Yeah.
Can I just ask one more question about the scale of this music, of the solo record? Is it designed explicitly to avoid the chance of a Still Into You happening? Is making the record sound how it does, those choices, sort of like, I don't want any one of these songs to then get out of control, which would then force me to have to make some decisions.
Force me to have to go on The Voice again.
No, I don't think it's a conscious, like, okay, I'm going to try to make the anti Still Into You. This is like the kind of music I like to make.
We were talking about
the anti-commercial delivery of it, but you don't think the songs itself themselves are anti-commercial.
I mean, I see that they are, and I like that about them.
Right. They're a little more alt.
Wow. We're bringing alt back?
We're bringing alt back.
Wow.
They're a little more alt. They're 90s alt.
That's what I mean.
Fucking cool.
To be fair, 90s alt got pretty big.
Pretty big. That's sort of what I'm saying. And I'm not convinced that is not a turn that popular music is going to take. I think it might take that turn. But I just wonder, you talk about really being protective over the decisions that you want to make and sort of keeping certain space for yourself. But one thing about the internet these days and social, like, things are unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you were confronted with all of a sudden one of these things becomes a TikTok trend, or, you know, like, not, you're not hiring. We know who you hire. Like, we're not hiring those people.
If you just F around and go viral.
Yes. Then what? How will you reckon with that?
I would like to think I would just listen to my gut and I would say no if I needed to say no to something. But I made this music with my friend Daniel, who the guys and I have grown up around, kind of idolizing. He's an amazing artist in his own right, but a great producer. Great. We had such a good time writing these songs, but we were just trying to tap into stuff we were into, like that whole scene in Copenhagen and like these artists that, I mean, he's been on that tip for a really long time. He lived over there and was in a band, this band called Efterklang, over there for a moment. Okay. So there's so much going on in the background besides just what people know of me and Paramore. I don't really listen to anything that sounds like Paramore. Yeah. It's like, I think one of my favorite bands of all time, but I don't really listen to Paramore. I just love what Paramore is about for me. I listen to stuff that just like inspires me. And then we go and we make stuff and kind of hope that we get close to the things that make us feel cool, like make us feel like we want to be musicians. So I think if a song like blew up and I didn't like have any say in it, fuck, who's going to complain about that? Like, cool. The writers want that moment more than anything.
But you don't feel it's going to pull you.
Because I'm not impressed by it.
Yeah.
You've been there. You've been in those rooms.
Yeah.
You've been on stage with Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
And like, and honestly, I loved that. That was like the honor of our fucking life and career. But there's nothing like a Paramore show. I'd rather be at a Paramore show. You know what I mean? All day long, I'd rather be at a Paramore show with the people that, like I said, have grown up with us, that know that part of us. It's like, I don't know, it feels like family. So to me, I think I have enough of an internal compass and like a real strong sense of my own intuition that I'm just like listening to that every day and it's happening in real time. I feel like this is such an experiment because it's the first time I feel like I've been totally comfortable and okay. The first album, COVID happened. I actually didn't have a choice. I had to shut it down.
Yeah. It was never going to get that big.
It was never gonna...
Unless you're Dua Lipa. COVID was its own handicap.
But this is my chance to also emulate the music and the artists that like made me want to do this in the first place, none of which were big artists. So I think if it happens to take off in one way, great. But I'm going to be here just trying to keep getting better at guitar, you know?
And I have to ask, did the embrace from Taylor, someone like that, like how unexpected was that? And do you hear a little bit of Paramore in Taylor.
Is I do now? Yes.
Because I do. Yeah. I absolutely
oh,
do.
That's cool.
Definitely in her pop punk moment.
Yeah, yeah.
But Better Than Revenge. I'm like, yeah, what did I influence with yeah, that?
No,
it's like Misery Business came first, right?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it did. It did. Because Speak Now was during Brand New Eyes for us.
2010.
Yeah. She's always been so vocally supportive of our band. She's also been the first person anytime we've been nominated or won a Grammy. I literally get a text from her before I get a text from my family.
Yeah, sure.
She really, like,
she had a scene phase. Let's not pretend totally she wasn't on MySpace.
Yeah.
We know the MySpace. We see you, Taylor.
It felt like we got asked to be on the biggest tour in music history. It's because that's what it was. And it was.
And you did it.
We did it. It was unreal. We were exhausted when we got home. But like, I'm never going to see photos of myself dressed as Freddie Mercury at Wembley and not be psyched that we did that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. And it's to me, like, the gratifying thing is, number one, obviously seeing the influence of what you did in remanifested into someone like Taylor, who's like expanding
cool.
it.
That's
but then also,
fine.
You know, you're Olivia Rodrigo's. And so, like, all these people, I'm just like, oh, like, everybody grew up on Paramount. Like this is very clear to me.
That is a wild thing.
But I mean,
I'm still metabolizing it. I'm still seeing it, like, play out. I don't know when people are going to get sick of us, because I've been sick of us like 20 times by now. But I'm so honored to like get to do it, and I'm also very relieved to get to try something new and flex different muscles and be like, you gotta deconstruct this system that you were a part of on multiple levels. Like I gotta tear down Paramore the same way I had to tear down my evangelical upbringing. I have to do it for me to grow up, because I don't want to be stuck in a traumatized 18-year-old's headspace for the rest of my life. I'm 36. It's not cute anymore.
Before we move on to our lightning round, I have to ask about the current state of Paramore. As if things weren't fraught enough in the history of the band, you entered into a relationship with one of your band members. And now there's, again, same as 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, a lot of speculation about how the lineup dynamic affects what Paramore could become. Like, is that PTSD for you to then see, oh, I'm all grown up and it's still the same conversations about, you know, is Haley breaking up Paramore?
I mean, it is PTSD, but this is the moment in my life where I think I get to reclaim a lot of things for me, the person. I've been heavy on the reminiscing lately and thinking about the full circle moment of, celebrating 20 years. There's a lot of reasons that I think I could be triggered every day right now, but I do feel like I've done the internal work to understand why people are interested. I mean, we all grew up on the internet. Everything is parasocial. You can't avoid it. I don't resent our fans for being that way. But look, Paramore's not ever going away. If I woke up tomorrow and hated it and was like, fuck Paramore, it's not going away. But it's my favorite band. And I think I think that we need breaks. Like, we are three people that have been in a washing machine since we were teenagers. And it really affected all three of us in vastly different ways. And this is not a moment that I get to say what the future, I don't get to say like, well, this is exactly what we're going to do next. Because like I've been saying my whole career, Paramore's a band. Like I don't get to decide. And it wasn't time to make another Paramore record, but I had a lot of shit to say. So I've done what I've done for myself and made this record. But speaking to the parasocial aspect of it, I'm trying to do things this time around in a way that can communicate to the people who care. I don't feel like I owe the wider world an explanation of what, like, my real life. I just feel like the people that care are going to read into what I'm saying. And that's where I put that part of my life. That's where I put the things that I feel, the things I'm struggling with, my losses, my gains, just all of it.
In the music.
Into the music. And I think that the right people are like they're there to catch me, you know? And that's like what I feel this moment in my career. I'm finally willing to like let that happen. And it's okay that it's me by myself and not Paramore right now. Paramore will always have its time because that's just what we do. We cycle back in and out of it. We resent it 1 minute. We want to like wear matching clothes, and the next minute we want to like wear trash bags.
We gotta find a photo of those early matching outfits.
I think I have a lot of them.
Okay, well, yeah, send them along.
If I don't have them, I know where to find them on the internet. Yeah. But we have such a special relationship with the people who care about Paramore, and this record is for them. Even though it's not Paramore, I hope they know it's for them. And I'm doing the same shit I've always done. I'm writing about my life, and they're the only people that have ever really cared in the right way. So they can have it, but I don't really want to. I just don't like everybody else. All the articles that would get written about if I said everything that goes on in our band, you know, our band's conversations and my life and my family. Like, I just think then it wouldn't be mine to keep anymore. It wouldn't be my life anymore.
Let's hit a couple questions in the lightning round.
I'm terrified. I'm
right. No.
52 cards in the Popcast deck. Each one corresponds to a pre-written question.
Okay.
Let's see what you pull.
Okay.
All right, we got an eight of hearts.
All right, well, this is what we're not like advanced enough. Eventually, we'll have the deck with the questions on.
Oh,
them,
yeah.
But we're not there
you
yet.
You should make those for Popcast so that people can.
Yes, play it at home.
Yes.
Yeah, our merch. By the way, buy our merch.
That's a good idea.
You can Google it.
Do you guys actually have merch?
Yeah,
we got some merch. You see the deck?
Deck.
Oh, shit. Are you going to do the popped collar merch?
Now I didn't even know. I can't believe with everything I've written about men. Fashion in the last 20 years, I can't believe I did not know that there was a popped collar polo shirt with text on the pop.
It's genius. Yeah.
Did we invent that? Cypress Creek High School 06? Class of 06?
I just want to, like, menswear nerd
reunion. I'm going to wear it.
If you were a hashtag menswear nerd on Tumblr in the late 2000s, early 2010s, get at me. I want to know if this is a one. Like, is that
your world?
It's a world I'm aware of. I have a lot of worlds.
Wow.
But like, here's the thing. People out here talking about Bodhi senior chords.
Yeah.
Whatever about that.
But now you're taking us off the rails.
But I'm just simply saying, I want to know about
Pop Collar. We're not talking about Bodhi on Popcast. Read the question.
First of all, it's my show too. Eight of hearts. All right. Straightforward. What's your best lyric?
This is terrible.
Can I just call one out before you answer from the new album?
Yes. Yes.
You correct me if I paraphrase it wrong.
Okay.
Made a lot of dumb motherfuckers a lot of money. What's the line?
A lot of dumb motherfuckers that I made rich.
There we go.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I had to be high for that.
You're in your bag.
Yeah. I had to get so stoned to speak my truth on that. That song, that was an exorcism, that song. I'm really proud of it.
Ice in my OJ.
Opening track of the album, which I wouldn't have expected to happen, but that one's good. I'm glad you called that one out because I don't think I would have called that out. I would have tried to go with something like super poetic.
No, but what's your best lyric to you today?
To me, what I'm the most proud of is the second pre-chorus of True Believer, where I reference Strange Fruit. Strange Fruit, hard bargain. Until the roots, southern. I also reference this neighborhood in Franklin, like really close to where I grew up, called Hard Bargain. And Hard Bargain was like, I don't know how many acres. I feel like it was like 17 acres or something like that, that this formerly enslaved man bought from his former enslaver. It's still there. It's still, I feel like it's all Black, but predominantly Black families. And it's protected now. But of course, you know, Franklin and Nashville are being gentrified all the time. The city takes care of its tourists more than it takes care of any of us.
Hence the bachelorette party.
yes.
imagery on the album.
Yes. So I'm really proud of the fact that I wrote about my city, but I was also able to inject this history that I'm aware of that I think is really important to pass on. I mean, there's been so many people that have told me they didn't know the Strange Fruit reference. So the lyric is, I might have to think of the whole second chorus, but so they put up... They put up chain link fences underneath the biggest bridges. They pose in Christmas cards with guns as big as all their children. They say that Jesus is the way. And so they gave him a white face. So, you know, and then the South will not rise again until it's paid for every sin. Strange fruit, hard bargain. Till the roots, Southern Gotham.
The South will not rise again till it's paid for every sin.
I'm so proud of it. I feel like I, you know, when you write something in only so many lines that holds a lot more meaning than just the lines itself, whether that's via double entendres or whatnot, I just felt like a real lyricist when I finished that. And I still was very scared of it because we're talking about stuff that's really important. But I was like, okay, I said the thing that I feel, and I said it in a way that is succinct, and I'm proud of it. But more proud of kind of the life it's taken since then and the conversations that I think the song has helped to start. That's like, again, that's dreams as a writer. You want to start conversation. And I haven't done a lot of that, admittedly, as much as other than
Misery Business. Which, you know, a valuable conversation.
Now, yes.
And a great song.
Thank you.
Let's be honest.
It's a good karaoke song. Okay. How many of these are we doing?
We'll do five. Five total. Poker hand. Oh, boy, you're about to have a straight flush.
Your hand's looking good.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Who's your OG? Which is to say, who do you turn to for advice?
We talked about your lack of mentors, but I assume that's changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It's my best friend, Brian O'Connor. He's probably watching. Brian. Hi, Brian. He is, I've known him since I was 17, and I don't know if you've noticed this about me, but I like to keep my friend. I like to grow up with my friends. And I think he's the person that I've talked to the most through all my seasons and all my horrible decision-making. I don't have a lot of friends in our industry, which I think sometimes I regret. I'm like, what did I do wrong? Or
why was the industry not set up for me to form bonds with people?
Yes. And why, you know, I mean, we were so young too. There's not anybody else our age on the road, but that's my dude.
Two of clubs.
Okay. The poker hand's not getting better.
It really took a turn.
Okay.
Oh, not the side.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we've had this one. I don't think anybody's pulled this card.
Okay.
When was the last time that you let someone down? Whatever that was, that's the answer. Yeah. Whatever.
All year. This has been a year of me having to choose myself and having to like make decisions. We had a song on our last album called Thick Skull.
Only I know where all the bodies are buried.
And we finished the cycle with it and with a video for it that I didn't really realize was like, I didn't realize how meaningful it was until way later. I think that I've directly and indirectly let so many people down through our career. And sometimes that was because a major label was, you know, trying to convince my parents that it was the right thing to do to sign a 15-year-old girl. And then other times it was breakups. And this year, I think, in trying to get away from this arrested development, you know, part of myself. I think when you start to have boundaries and choose yourself, it pisses a lot of people off. And it's so hard for me. It kills me to let anyone down, but especially people that you love, you know, it's like, it's really, really hard to do. And I'm in the thick of it. I feel like I'm in the thick of it because I still have so much to digest about my life up till 36 and the ways I've been let down, but didn't really feel like I was allowed to express that. But then I've felt like a letdown. I don't know. I don't feel like I'm talking super eloquently about it because it all feels new to me still to like...
To choose yourself.
To choose myself to like not have to apologize for doing something that feels okay for me or to take care of myself before I take care of everyone else in the room. You know, I spent my whole life protecting Paramore like we were the Lost Boys and I was fucking Wendy, you know? And I'm just like, I gotta take care of me. And that's, I'm trying to do it. And oh my God, like we might talk a year from now and I might be like, I made the worst decisions of my life when I was 36, but maybe not.
Popcast is a known place for self-care, just FYI. So you're doing the right thing.
We're
widely known. Yeah.
Two more. Okay. You'll pull a full, fun one. I feel it.
This is when Justin Vernon was here. Justin Vernon pulled a Full House.
Did he really?
It was very strange.
He would pull
really strange, like magical, like real magic. Okay, well, this is it's a great question. Not exactly for you, but there's an analog. Okay. The question is, what's a beat you wish you'd rapped on?
I think that's a great question.
There's an answer. Or alternately, what's a song that you wish you'd sung on?
Oh my God.
But if actually it's the rapping, I'd love to know that. Yeah, so would the world.
Yeah. Two Live Crew, Pop That Pussy.
Yeah, let's go.
That's the one.
Where were you guys in 89?
There you go.
Well, my mom just told me I was in her belly and my dad and her were like cruising, listening to that song. And I was like,
down in Mississippi.
This is not the Joey Williams I thought I knew. Wow. You know what I mean? Wow. Love it.
It's
though.
A different kind of evangelism.
Oh, the fact that my dad was listening to Band in the USA in Mississippi in the late 80s.
Pretty crazy.
You had no knowledge of that.
My mom just told me this.
She's
like, wow. Oh, we love that album.
I was like, Mom, what did you and Dad listen to when you guys were still friends? I'm like, what were you guys listening to? And she was like, you really want to know? And I was like, this is the best.
You're
like,
yeah, that's great. You were cool.
That's great.
So Two Live Crew.
Oh, that's great.
I don't think
you can top that.
I can't.
Genuine. I'm so glad you pulled that card.
Yeah, me too.
Which one is this? The five?
Five of clubs. Yes.
All right. Five of clubs.
You should get a tarot deck next. You know,
that's our spinoff.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. Podcast seance. Yeah. Okay. This is you're ending on a light note.
Thank fuck.
It's late night, or even you're on the road. You're in who knows where, Indiana, Nebraska. You pull off to the gas station on the road. What's the gas station order? What's the bodega order? What's the chip?
I wish I remembered J-Lo's bodega order so I could say
it. Just repeat J-Lo's.
Yeah, it's a good bit.
My go-to order at the bodega was ham and cheese on a roll with an orange drink, if you know, you know, and a small bag
of chips.
I
would get Arizona green tea.
Green tea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dollar can.
If there was a Subway, I would get like 6-inch sub on white bread with lettuce. This is the worst sandwich.
Lettuce,
tomato, banana, peppers, like basically all the veggies I could do, salt and pepper, oil and vinegar, and pickles also. But no meat, like, you know, just that.
I know you've toured in bands if you're imagining like a Subway attached to a gas station.
That's
the rest stop. You're talking rest stop. Yeah, classic.
But Arizona green tea was the one. And then I was also like, I wasn't supposed to have dairy. I wasn't supposed to, you know, I was trying to take care of my throat and I always was losing my voice. So I would get like, maybe I would get Mounds, but I would mostly get almonds or like walnuts.
Oh my.
So boring. It was awful.
Right. This leads us perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, no, this was not a setup.
Segment.
Not a setup.
Okay.
Every episode of Popcast ends with a snack test.
Yes, okay.
We try something from our pantry, which you walked in, and You spent, I will say, the most time in front of the pantry of any guest ever.
Yeah.
It's really.
We get a lot of impulse picks that we want to impose narrative onto, but they're just no narrative.
But you were considering, you were picking stuff up, you were looking, you were like, do I want to go new? Do I want to go foreign? Yeah. Do I want to go.
Just trying to figure out what the buds wanted.
And I think under some pressure, because we need to start, you picked something that you already know and love, but that we haven't tried. So these are wild strawberry candy kittens.
What company?
Gourmet candy from London.
But like, what company?
Is it Candy Kittens?
Are.
Yeah, so Candy Kittens.
But is that the name of the candy or is that the name of the company that makes the candy?
You want the parent company?
Is it a Cadbury product? Is it like what? Right, who's making them?
I feel like it's independent.
It's indie.
No,
it's on Vagrant.
Candy Kittens. it's a fake indie candy.
It's an upstream. VFW hall tonight.
Are you sure it's not upstreamed Vagrant?
This is UK Candy Kittens, 8 Broadstone Place in London.
Wow.
We're pulling up to Broadstone Place and get them from the
gourmet
source.
Gourmet sweets.
I know what they're doing.
Strawberry flavor.
Okay.
So yeah, I got these
vegan,
in London.
Gluten-free.
Yeah.
All the little...
No nasties, all good is the catchphrase.
Sponsor us, Candy Kittens.
I want nasties.
And also, like,
listeners of podcasts know I do not like strawberry flavor.
You don't like strawberry?
Flavor.
I'm so sorry. Okay. Oh, okay. But there's no nasties. What if it's real strawberry?
So it's like, it's a cat.
What if it's real?
It's a cat head, but it's like deformed.
But like it deformed is. In transit or deformed by design?
We'll never know. Sweet potato and black carrot plant concentrate.
This is healthy candy.
There's potato protein in this.
I didn't intentionally buy this because it was healthy.
It doesn't taste healthy. Don't worry.
Yeah, it doesn't. They're really good. My philosophy really good. Is that if you eat snacks that are no nasties, you can have more of them.
Mm.
So I do eat a lot of vegan, gluten-free snacks.
Smells vegan.
Does it really?
Doesn't taste it. I like this.
I don't like this furrow.
I like it.
Oh, you like it.
I like it.
I like the, there's some kind of like, there's like a, you know, like the Lifesaver creamy ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's something of that.
There is they're a little milky.
Is it the potato protein?
It might be the potato. As a non-strawberry flavor fan, this is better than an artificial strawberry flavor. I don't hate it at all. I'm going to just give it a solid 7 out of 10. I wouldn't eat whole bag. For rating. You want to do a decimal? We could do a decimal.
Yeah.
7.3.
So is that what your album got on Pitchfork?
Yeah.
Is it actually?
Hilarious.
Did you look like it was Christmas morning and you're like, what's
tell,
under
but
the tree?
I opened my Instagram and it was there.
It was served to you.
It was served up on a platter.
Right.
But the last Paramore album got lower than that.
Okay. So you topped your band.
You have like the ranking board. You like put it up on the board. Like, yes, rearrange it.
But I joke with them a lot because they love to use me for clicks. But so I commented, I said, well, what will you rate it in 10 years? Because I'll change it for sure.
Ooh.
I might rate it lower.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But if my experience in this industry has anything to do with it, someone will reevaluate and be like, she was
pretty good.
It was cool. It was fun.
It was 7.3.
Nothing to sniff at.
No,
media is dying and no one clicks on anything anymore. Yeah, I'm maxed out. But
they're all yours. They're all yours.
Really?
This is the thing. That's a 7 out of 10.
Thank you.
One bite, but I wouldn't eat many. And most gummies, I have to eat the whole bag.
Yeah, I'm okay. So like, this is a style of candy, gummy with whatever's on the outside.
Sour.
Yeah, like dust. It's not a preferred style of candy for me.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say is it chews harder than like a Haribo.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit, it's durational in a way that I'm kind of like, I'm ready for it to be over, but it's not over.
And you only took a little nibble.
This is the third one because I tried to like give it another
durational.
Shot. It's durational.
It's crazy.
It's not bad.
Do you like chocolate stuff more than like this kind of sweet?
No, I actually really don't. Like I don't, I'm very Catholic in my taste. Like I can like and dislike unpredictable
like
things. I don't, non-drinker, but yes, spiritually.
I have another one.
It's, you know what, the flavor's
good.
Like look, the flavor, you you're right, you. The you flavor's good.
The staff, but then, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the flavor's good.
Like, flavor's not bad because it's real strawberry.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's a 7, but if it had the lightness of a Haribo with this flavor, 8.5.
Okay. Haribo is notoriously hard to chew.
No, it's gelatinous. It's sticky, but it's not thick.
It is.
This is thick.
Haribo is tough.
No, Haribo's like the peaches, the Haribo tough. Peaches, not the...
Oh, the peaches.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not Haribo. That's not main Haribo.
You should try the watermelon ones of these.
You're talking about the peaches. Okay,
they're lighter.
Yes. It is peaches. It is tougher than
that's
the peaches,
better.
But
the watermelon is a little lighter.
Softer than like the cherries or whatever.
The Steph, the producer writer that I wrote Parachute with, and she wrote with me for Petals Farmer too. I found this company from her, and she always sends them from London. But this is the first time I've had the strawberry one.
All right.
Oh, okay.
So
the watermelon is better.
I would
prefer the watermelon.
Okay. Good right. to know.
I think y'all would like the I implore you more, to give the candy kittens another try.
But you're sticking with your 7.3.
Yeah, I'm so sticking with 7.3.
We're all there. Like it's like yeah, you we know, agree.
You just want more.
I think I'm just hungry too. I'm just like, oh, wow, I didn't.
No, we
it's
I mean,
sticking around.
We've been going.
Like top back of my it's sticking around.
Like in the teeth?
No. The flavor, like the kind of like the ode that is like it's at the top. That I'm going down to 6.5. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I should be over it by now. Yeah, I'm sorry.
He reevaluated.
I know. In the time we're talking, it's just falling.
I need to leave.
Like
quick.
Your pitchfork scores.
Wow. Saved it for the end there, Joe. Jeez.
Oh, my God.
What a tremendous conversation. Haley Williams.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here.
I loved this.
It's a joy for us, a true joy. Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/podcast. As Haley, we have merch. Just, it's in the description. The link is in the description. Go buy a mug.
Like and subscribe first and then go
shop. Yes, like and subscribe first. And then if you find where the t-shirts are, I made new t-shirts recently. Go get a t-shirt. We're on Instagram. We're on TikTok. We're on YouTube at Popcast and all of those places. Credits and link in bio. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye. Ain't it fun?